Shrink Wrap Radio number 34, April 23rd, 2006. 40 years of consciousness research. Welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio, the planet's premier psychology podcast. This is your host, Dr. Dave, coming to you from the San Francisco Bay Area. Shrink Wrap Radio is the show that speaks from the psychologist in me to the psychologist in you, whether you be amateur, student, or professional.
Other intelligent men and women were going through the same kind of crisis, and they realized science was right in a lot of ways. There was a lot of nonsense in religion, but was it all nonsense? And they came up with the brilliant idea of, can we apply the method of science, not the particular findings at any moment, but the method, to investigate various phenomena of spirituality and religion and begin to separate out what was true and important and what was false and superstitious. That was an inspiring vision for me, and basically that's what I've been doing the last 50 years.
Those are the words of Dr. Charles Tart, who has long been one of the world's leading researchers on consciousness. In 1969, he edited a groundbreaking book titled Altered States of Consciousness. That book had a large impact, making it legitimate for many others, including myself, to conduct their own research into such areas as mutual dreaming, lucid dreaming, out-of-the-body experiences, meditation, psychedelic experiences, and other such phenomena that had long been off the beaten path. For most of his career, Dr. Tart was professor of psychology at the University of California at Davis, where he now holds the title of Professor Emeritus. Since leaving UC Davis, he has joined the faculty of the Institute of Transpersonal Psychology in Palo Alto, California. His list of publications and presentations runs into the hundreds. I'm very excited to bring you this interview. While we've long been aware of one another's work, this was our first opportunity to speak. Here's the conversation. Dr. Charles Tart, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
It's a pleasure to be here, David.
Okay, well, you've had such a rich career covering such areas as consciousness, transpersonal psychology, and parapsychology, and I feel like I'm sitting at this great buffet, and I hardly know where to jump in or where to start.
Well, that's all right. I hardly know where I'm going next a good deal of the time.
Okay.
It's awfully rich.
Okay. I do have one burning question, and it relates to the fact that your career has been devoted to exploring very non-traditional areas in psychology, yet somehow you were, for most of your career, a professor at the University of California at Davis. Now, UC Davis strikes me as a very traditional institution for such a non-traditional guy. How did you pull that off?
Well, it wasn't easy.
I'll bet.
As one of my colleagues there used to frequently remind me, he'd said, "You're a pioneer, Charlie, and a pioneer is somebody with a lot of arrows in his back."
Yeah, exactly. Wow.
So, I think I basically got my job there to begin with because I was doing sleep and dream research back in the 60s when that was a very hot new area.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, I had physiological equipment, which made it seem very respectable.
Okay.
And they knew I had some weird interests, but they sort of hoped I'd outgrow them. Their hope wasn't met that way.
It always puzzled me because I thought, how is this guy flying under the radar?
Well, you know, part of it, too, was that a department's budget depended on how many students they taught in their major.
Uh-huh.
And my Altered States of Consciousness class usually drew several hundred students, which helped the department budget considerably.
Oh, that's great. That explains it. Well, I can just imagine, having come up through academia myself, the kinds of political challenges that you might have faced.
Oh, yeah. The politics drove me crazy sometimes.
Right.
Wasted a lot of time.
Right. Now, it's hard to believe, you mentioned your book, Altered States of Consciousness, which I know had a profound impact on me. I was already sort of headed down that track, and then when I saw the book, it was like, for me, it was mind-blowing. It was like, oh, this is exactly what I'm interested in.
And That was my intention.
Yeah, and it's hard to believe. I guess it's close to 40 years now since that book came out.
1969 it came out. Yeah, it's getting on toward 40.
Yeah, and in that...
But you know what's terrible about that, David? What's terrible is that it's still one of the best books on altered states around 40 years later.
Hmm.
And because, you know, my hope was that it would stimulate an enormous amount of research on all sorts of aspects of altered states. And that happened in a few areas, but not in a lot of others. So, unfortunately, it's not outdated.
Wow.
That's a disappointment.
Yeah, I could see. Well, it's a good thing and it's a bad thing. And also, is it true that the book's out of print?
Yes, the book is out of print, yeah.
And that is a sad thing. I'm surprised that nobody's been motivated to bring it back into print.
Well, I've thought about it, but when I remember all the work I had to do to get all the copyright permissions for all those different chapters in there, it discourages me.
Yeah. In that book, I urge our listeners to go out and find it. I mean, you can find used copies out there somewhere, I'm sure, if you hunt hard enough or go to libraries.
If you look on it on Amazon, used copies will come up, no problem.
Yeah. And in that book, you pulled together a diverse set of articles that really launched a whole new field of study, or at least I thought it did. Evidently, not as much study followed on the heels of it as you had hoped for.
Well, that was my hope, and it worked pretty well. You know, because I had very unusual interests, I knew that there were a fair number of decent writings on various altered states like hypnosis or meditation scattered around. But because they were so scattered, they had almost no impact because no one person would ever come across any significant number of them. So my hope was by putting them together in that altered states book, it could make people realize, oh, yeah, consciousness does undergo radical changes, and they're important, and we ought to study them and use them. And it worked for a while.
Right. And also, by studying altered states of consciousness, it helps us to understand normal consciousness better.
Yes. In fact, I joke sometimes that after years of looking at exotic states like hypnosis and meditation or drug-induced states, I may be getting ready to take on that really mysterious state, so-called ordinary consciousness.
Yeah, exactly. Now,
the one we think we understand, but don't really understand much about at all.
Yeah, exactly. We're like the proverbial fish in water that are unaware of the water in which they swim. What is it that got you, this may be a personal question, but I dive in anyway, what got you interested in altered states of consciousness in the first place?
No, that's a perfectly reasonable question, actually. And it's also good in the sense of teaching purposes in that people like to hear a personal slant on
definitely
things. It makes the material less abstract. I'd say all this started when I was a teenager and going through a religious conflict crisis that I think an awful lot of people go through.
Mm-hmm.
Right? I was raised in a conventional religion. My grandmother took me to church and Sunday school. You know, this was my grandmother, the source of love. It was good enough for her. It was good enough for me. And I was very deeply involved in that kind of Lutheranism. But then as a teenager, I started to think for myself.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, like most teenagers, I started noticing the hypocrisy of the adults around me. These people didn't practice the religion they preached very well. And I became more and more aware of science and started thinking for myself. So I began to see this so common conflict between religious claims on one hand and the scientific data that seemed to say that this religion was all nonsense and superstition. Now, when I look back with the wisdom of hindsight, I see there are two major ways people deal with this kind of conflict. In one of them, they convert to science and say, right, religion is all a lot of crap, let's forget all that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Yet as a psychologist, I know that something important is being lost about our spiritual potential when somebody does that. The other common route I saw was that people sort of compartmentalized themselves. You know, religion was something for Saturday or Sunday, and then you didn't think about it the rest of the week and apparently avoided conflict that way.
Mm-hmm.
But that kind of dissociation has high psychological cost, too.
Right.
I was very lucky in my reading because I came across the old literature on psychical research, as it was called back in the 1890s and so, where other intelligent men and women were going through the same kind of crisis, and they realized science was right in a lot of ways. There was a lot of nonsense in religion, but was it all nonsense? And they came up with the brilliant idea of, can we apply the method of science, not the particular findings at any moment, but the method to investigate various phenomena of spirituality and religion and begin to separate out what was true and important and what was false and superstitious. That was an inspiring vision for me, and basically that's what I've been doing the last 50 years,
yes.
Trying to separate out some of what's true and vital about spirituality from what is indeed just old superstition.
Yeah, that's great.
And it's been fun.
Yeah, that's great background. Now, this book came out at the tail end of the 60s, so I have to ask, did you experiment personally with psychedelics?
Well, as a matter of fact, I can make a very unusual claim. I was given psychedelics on quite a few occasions under the auspices of the CIA.
Wow.
I was a research subject for research done by a psychiatrist while I was in graduate school. And years later, I found out that the foundation that had funded and sponsored his research was one of the front foundations the CIA set up to promote research on psychedelics.
Oh, wow.
Now, of course, I don't think they got the results they really wanted, and I do mean to keep sending my thank you letter to the CIA, although I haven't gotten around to it, because I certainly had a lot of insights into psychological factors that way that I might not have had otherwise.
Yeah, I was curious about that. What relationship that those experiences, what bearing they might have had on your subsequent career?
Oh, yeah, they really brought things home for me.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, now, a lot of people talk about having psychedelic experiences and their framework for looking at the world changes drastically. It wasn't that my framework changed so much. I was already interested in altered states and parapsychological stuff. I had a much wider framework than most people. But it was kind of all in my head. So, for instance, I mentioned the word dissociation a while ago in terms of how some people deal with religious conflicts. I knew what it meant intellectually, but I really had no experiential feel for it. You know, that was some weird idea that happened to other people.
Right.
But I can remember one of my first psychedelic experiences where I was asked to do a very boring kind of psychological test. And I kind of had to do it because it was an experiment and I'd agreed to cooperate and all that. But I wasn't interested in anything so boring.
Yeah, really.
So much to my amazement, I saw part of my mind dissociate and do the psychological test stuff while I went off and had more interesting adventures somewhere else.
Interesting.
And I realized, oh, that's what dissociation is.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, that's great. Your experience matches mine somewhat because that certainly was one of the factors that, as you say, I was already on this track, but it certainly helped me to understand it in a very different way.
Or beauty is an example. I knew the word beauty. I used it all the time in ordinary conversation, but it was only when I had sort of the hyper beauty kind of experience that the psychedelic drugs could induce that I really understood this stuff in depth.
Yes.
Just a conventional word.
Right, right. Now, you've sort of already foreshadowed this a bit, but I'll ask it anyway. And the question that I had to ask was, what's happened in the field of altered states of consciousness since your book came out?
Well, initially there was a very positive response. A lot of courses were set up, for instance, to study altered states.
Mm-hmm.
And
I taught one, by the way.
Yeah. And they haven't lasted too much, but that was very good for broadening people.
Mm-hmm.
And in a few areas, more research was done. So, for instance, if I were redoing the section on lucid dreams in my Altered States book now, that's something where there's a lot of new and exciting stuff that's come in.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, the section on psychedelic research that I had, it's one of those things that's not outdated. Because about the time the book came out, basically psychedelic research was legally stopped.
Right.
And all sorts of important research questions just didn't get researched anymore.
Right, right.
Meditation research, of course, has expanded enormously.
Yes.
In 1969, when I published the Altered States book, I bragged in my introduction to the section on meditation that I was reprinting 2/3 of the English language scientific literature on meditation, which sounded pretty impressive.
Yeah.
So you realize it was 2 of the 3 studies that existed.
Right, right.
Now, there are hundreds and hundreds of studies of meditation because some people found some physiological correlates which legitimized the thing.
Mm-hmm.
But still, the real meditation research largely remains to be done, okay? Most of the hundreds of research studies that have been done have been on kind of meditation as a stress reducer. And it is a stress reducer, but so is taking a nap or taking a walk or something like that. We're only now really beginning to get into what meditation is about of promoting spiritual growth.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Your website, which I'll put a link in our show notes to your website.
Thank you.
It's a wonderful resource that really just allows a person to branch out into lots of different directions. And there are links to the many books that you've written and to the articles you've written and to lots of cassette tapes so that anybody who wanted to learn more about any of these areas, certainly that is a great jumping off place.
Well, the cassette tapes are temporarily unavailable now.
Oh, really? That's too bad.
My daughter, who was running that ordering business for me, and she's in school now, and we've had to put a stop to that.
Oh,
but there are lots of articles and stuff there.
Yeah.
Yes,
now, I have a listener in Baghdad who asked me some questions just very recently about reincarnation, and he told me that reincarnation is not part of the Islamic faith, but still he was curious about it. And I noticed on your website some references to research on reincarnation and survival after death. Perhaps you can give us a brief overview of the current state of research into those areas.
Well, it's only one of the most important questions in the world, for sure.
Right.
A brief overview, what the heck?
Yeah.
I mean, I think most people, if they knew, for instance, that there was a lot of evidence that said we've survived death in some form versus a lot of evidence that said, no, death is the end, that's it, it would make a big difference in the way you'd lead your life.
Mm-hmm.
Like my personality, if I know I'm probably going to be stuck with the effects of my personality for a long, long, long time, I'm going to act differently than if I think, you know, oh, what the heck, 10 more years or so, I'm dead. What difference does it make?
Yeah.
What most people don't realize is that you can research the question of some kind of survival after death. It doesn't have to be a matter of believe it or don't believe it, and it's just sort of arbitrary. There is research on that. And to summarize 100 years of research in a sentence or two, there are enough positive and interesting findings from research on postmortem survival to say that it may be real.
Mm-hmm.
And so we certainly should be researching it extensively instead of what? I'm one of the most knowledgeable people on the planet about it, and I've done almost zero research on it. That's ridiculous. That's shameful. As far as the specific reincarnation aspect of it, the main impressive body of research there is that of the psychiatrist Ian Stevenson at the University of Virginia and his colleagues in his laboratory there, Bruce Grayson, Jim Tucker, people like that. And again, they have enough cases of little kids who spontaneously start talking about previous incarnations that I'm very impressed.
Huh.
I mean, anybody who just dismisses reincarnation is ignorant. There's evidence that it might well happen. It certainly deserves a lot of research.
Wow. I have to confess.
Okay, so there's 100 years of research.
That's great. I have to confess I've not read that literature. I've heard Ian Stevenson's name and seen references
to it. Stevenson is a very careful researcher. His stuff is well worth reading.
Okay.
You know, and I say there's 100 years of research, and that sounds like a lot, but actually compared to the importance and complexity of the question, very little has been done in that 100 years.
Okay.
And almost nothing's being done now. Gary Schwartz at the University of Arizona is doing some interesting research with mediums. There's a little bit of mediumistic research going on in England. But generally, I have a discussion group on the Internet that I've run for 10 years now with most of the active people, the people who really know this literature. Most of them are not active researchers. They're just scholars who can devote a little of their time to thinking about what's been done in the past.
Mm-hmm.
That's crazy. You know, I think the question of whether or not we survive death is a lot more important than curing the common cold.
Do you think it might relate to research funding, that there's no money available?
There's no money available, and there's enormous prejudice against doing it, okay?
Yeah.
Any orthodox researcher who announced that she wanted to start investigating the possibility of survival after death might well lose her job.
Yes, yeah, definitely.
Well, those are some of the arrows in the back that the pioneers get.
Right. So we've already sort of starting to touch on parapsychology, and I know there are a number of links on your site to readings on parapsychology as well. Tell us a little bit about your own work in this area. You've done some parapsychological research in the past, haven't you?
Yeah, I used to devote about a third of my time to active parapsychological research, you know, with the rest kind of on aspects of consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
And I was particularly interested in the question of how do you make parapsychological things like telepathy work more effectively? Because it is, they don't work very effectively most of the time. You know,
right.
They happen spontaneously to people sometimes, or you get these laboratory effects where they're sort of statistically significant, but people are just guessing and imagining most of the time. So I spent a lot of time trying to apply basic learning theory to it. I said, you know, that if you tell somebody, read my mind, how are they supposed to interpret that, right? It's different if you say, lift your hand up and turn it over. That's a little variation on something you already know how to do and are very well practiced in. But what do you do to read somebody's mind? So I did a number of exploratory experiments where people were in a telepathy testing kind of situation, but they keep getting immediate feedback on how they were doing. And the idea was that eventually you could start figuring out correlations, you know.
Mm-hmm.
If I feel this way, I'm usually wrong. I probably should keep my mouth closed and wait till the feeling goes away. Whereas if I feel this other way, I tend to be right more than just chance. So let me try to understand and explore that. And I got enough initial positive results to encourage me that I was going in the right direction, mm-hmm. but I couldn't get the research support I needed to really explore that thoroughly.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And also there was a big sea change in parapsychology at the time. The remote viewing style of doing parapsychological research came along, which automatically incorporated this kind of immediate feedback.
Uh-huh.
And some people seem to keep up their abilities quite well with remote viewing or get better at it.
Interesting. So is anyone doing credible work on parapsychology currently?
Oh, yeah. There's a few people doing it, but they're largely away from the traditional university settings. You know, again, that's a real career killer to be interested in, much less do parapsychological research. The prejudice against this is very strong and very irrational.
Yeah, yeah. Now, you're currently on the faculty at the Institute for Transpersonal Psychology in Menlo Park, California.
Right. Palo Alto, actually.
Oh, it's at Palo Alto. Okay. And
what's
the state of transpersonal psychology today? I ask these tiny little questions, you know.
Well, the state in one way is very good and another way is very bad. It's very good in the sense that transpersonal psychology exists at all. I mean, here's a branch of psychology dedicated to taking the spiritual seriously. Not, you know, to naively believing everything that's labeled spiritual. Again, there's a lot of this idea that in the long run we need to separate out what's real and vital about spiritual ideas versus what's, you know, sort of traditional but maybe just superstition. That's the good side of it, that we exist at all. And, you know, we graduate a lot of students each year, go out and become good therapists and the like.
Mm-hmm.
The poor side of it is that an awful lot of research needs to be done. You know, at this stage, it's kind of a borrowing from historical spiritual systems and the like, mixed in with some modern psychology. But we need to do that research to separate the wheat from the chaff, and we have almost no money to do research.
Yeah, yeah.
Our faculty has very heavy teaching loads because it's the tuition that runs the school and all that, so we're not getting anywhere near as much research done as we need to do.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
One of my main causes at this stage of my life is trying to find research endowment kind of money to enable the faculty at ITP and other places to do more solid research in this area. I want to know, for instance, how do you teach spiritual practices so they're effective?
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you think about it, people are given all sorts of spiritual practices and all sorts of traditions, and most people stop doing them after a while because they don't get any results. That's terrible.
Yeah.
I mean, how can we work out what's effective for people in our modern day and age? Mm-hmm. That's where research comes in.
Okay. You've studied spiritual traditions, and you've written books on mindfulness and meditation. Not long ago, I heard you give a talk on enlightenment. Can you tell us anything about your own views on spirituality and enlightenment, your sort of post-Lutheran perspective?
Yeah, I felt I had a lot of chutzpah to give a talk on enlightenment, actually, since I'm clearly not enlightened, whatever enlightenment is. But the topic is too important. I mean, put that more generally as a topic of spiritual growth. It's too important to leave in the old authoritarian mold that there are a few people who are fully enlightened and we should simply do whatever they say.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe that will help, but they don't produce that many enlightened students. So clearly the system's kind of inefficient. We need to look from the ground up. What is spiritual growth? What kind of technique is effective for what particular kind of person? You know, the fantasy I have is that someday we'll get an issue of Consumers Reports, and it'll be the issue devoted to different spiritual paths. And it'll talk about what kind of warranties different spiritual paths carry, what kind of risks and so forth, and what's best for a particular person. We could research that, but at the moment it's a lot of hit or miss, and it's very inefficient.
Yeah.
I mean, just to take a personal example, for instance, I tried to learn how to meditate starting, 30, 40 years ago, and it didn't work. And I long ago decided that whatever talent it took to be a meditator, I didn't have it. I had to do other kinds of things.
Yeah.
And then 15, 20 years ago, when I met Shinzen Young particularly, I got taught it in a way that resonated with me. And, I could make some progress on this, you know. Maybe I do have some of the talent. I could make a little progress.
Why
didn't we know that more efficiently 40 years ago, so I wouldn't have wasted my time doing methods that simply didn't work for me?
What did you say did work for you?
I learned some meditation from a man named Shinzen Young.
Oh, okay.
He's a Westerner, actually, but Shinzen is the name he took when he became a monk in Japan years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And he's experimented a lot with adapting traditional Eastern meditation stuff to fit better in with Westerners,
mm-hmm.
and I think he's made a lot of progress there.
Mm-hmm. And so is that the basis of your book on meditation then? You've written a book, I think the title is Practical Meditation, isn't it?
Oh yeah, Mind Science, Meditation for Practical People. That's one of the bases. Mm-hmm. Also, teachings from Sogyal Rinpoche, a Tibetan Lama I've studied with a lot,
mm-hmm.
and mixed in with stuff from the Gurdjieff tradition. I'm a synthesizer there. I'm not a pure channel for any particular
right.
tradition, but I figure stuff that worked for me, who was probably not naturally suited for it, must work for some other people.
Mm-hmm.
And I've experimented with teaching workshops to scientists and intellectuals and scholars, and they've gotten something out of it. So I figure I'm doing something right.
Yeah, terrific. That's kind of how I am too, and, you know, kind of pick and choose what works for me. And I'm always really interested in the practical side of psychology, and, you know, if it doesn't work for us psychologists, then who are we to recommend it? So I'm wondering,
yes.
Has there ever been a time of crisis or transition in your life where your knowledge of esoteric psychology or traditional psychology or the spiritual traditions you've studied has kind of pulled you through?
Well, I suppose so, but I don't normally think in that style.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we have a bias in trying to understand spiritual traditions or anything else in life, actually, where the spectacular gets our attention.
Mm-hmm.
But I think a lot of personal and spiritual growth is a much slower kind of thing where the bad side of things just sort of gradually slides away without there being any particular crisis.
Mm-hmm.
So for me, and when I look back on my own growth, it's been more that sort of gradual evolution.
Okay.
It's not that I have some big dramatic experience and use this spiritual technique. It's more that I will suddenly notice, that bad habit of mine that I'd been doing for the past 25 years, I haven't done it in several years.
Hmm.
Gosh, that's nice. That sure takes a load off.
Great. Now,
but it makes a lousy story. There's nothing spectacular about it.
I believe one of your current projects is called TASTE. I think that's an acronym. Maybe you can tell us what that's all about.
It's an acronym for the Archives of Scientists' Transcendent Experiences. You know, because I'm known for my unusual interests, then when I give talks somewhere or write books or the like, a lot of people contact me about unusual experiences they've had. And that includes a lot of scientists where typically they'll say, I'm the first person they've ever mentioned this unusual experience to because they know they'd get in trouble with their colleagues
mm-hmm.
if they dared to talk about it at home.
Right.
Now, you know, that doesn't just apply to to scientists. It applies to people in all sorts of professions, but scientists are the one I work with. So sometimes just by being able to tell it to me, it's been sort of therapeutic for them. They've got it off their chest, right? Here's somebody who'll listen and won't look at them like they're crazy. So this website I started, the Archives of Scientists' Transcendent Experiences, TASTE, has been a place where scientists can anonymously, if they feel at all threatened, describe the transcendent spiritual and parapsychological kinds of experiences they've had, and not only get it off their chest, but have a chance to help other scientists realize, oh, this sort of thing happened. Now, another reason I've chosen scientists is I'm using social prejudices. I mean, don't you think if a physicist talks to God, it's more profound than if a plumber talks to God? That's silly.
I think, yeah, we have a kind of, I was going to ask you if this wasn't some kind of argument ad hominem in a kind of positive way.
No, I'm just riding on the coattails of social prejudices, mm-hmm. where we think physicists are inherently more profound people than plumbers.
I'm sure
there's a lot more plumbers that are much more profound than a lot of physicists.
Uh-huh.
I'll use the social prejudice.
Okay.
So anybody can read this, okay? And most of the visitors to the site are just people from all walks of life who share that prejudice of God. This is a research chemist who talked to an angel. That's so important.
Yeah.
But I only post experiences that come from people who are conventionally recognized as scientists.
Mm-hmm.
That also just simply keeps the load down so I don't get overloaded with a zillion things to work with.
Okay, so if people are interested in that, they'll be able to find that from that same website that I've mentioned before that I will post. So
Actually, you're going to post two website links.
One
is to my personal website that's got a lot of my articles and books and stuff there, and the other, the TASTE site, is specifically the Transcendent Experiences of Scientists.
Okay, I'll make sure that I've got both of those.
Right. That latter one, particularly, I'm trying to undermine the social stereotype that really smart people don't have anything to do with the spiritual.
Mm-hmm.
It's not true at all.
Mm-hmm. Good. Well, we're kind of at the end here. I wonder if there's anything that I haven't asked you about that I should have or that you'd want people to
probably
know. Probably. Anything that comes
to
mind?
I'll let you be inspired to figure out what that is. There's so many things I have fun talking about, so I leave it up to you.
Okay. Well, I really want to thank you for taking the time to give me this interview.
Oh, it's been a pleasure, David.
Okay.
And I hope the information that we've talked about is useful to people.
I'm sure it will be. So thanks so much.
Okay. Take care then.
Bye-bye. Thanks again to Charles Tart for granting this interview. He's long been one of my intellectual heroes, so it was a real treat to do this interview. Although he has had a much more high-profile career than mine, we have a lot in common. We're of the same generation. We both learned Morse code and became ham radio operators as kids. We both grew up in fairly strict Christian environments. We both questioned this early religious programming and explored broader approaches to spirituality. Clearly, we were both drawn to psychology. We both became psychology professors, and in the San Francisco Bay Area, no less, though neither of us grew up here. We both experienced psychedelics and have written on topics such as hypnosis, dreams, meditation, and ESP. And though we've not met in person, we have many friends in common. So I think you can see why I'm so pleased that podcasting has provided the opportunity to make contact with someone I see as a sort of soul brother. Charlie's book on altered states of consciousness came out toward the end of my graduate career at the University of Michigan. Prior to his book coming out, I had already had a long-standing interest in hypnosis, I had experimented with psychedelics, I was studying yoga, and I discovered some psychoanalytic writing that discussed altered states of consciousness. On the basis of all this, I decided I would do my doctoral orals in the broad area of altered states of consciousness. As I recall, it was at about that time that Tart's book on altered states of consciousness came out. It was the perfect book at the perfect time in terms of my own trajectory. I drew on it heavily for both my oral exams and later for the literature review for my dissertation, which was on the role of attention in meditation and hypnosis. I thought then, and I still do, that the ability to focus one's attention on a single thing
would tend to induce a shift in consciousness. Speaking of shifts in consciousness, I want to share with you what seems to be a precognitive dream experience from last night. Last night, I had one of those dreams that seems to go on and on, one that's mired down in some sort of repetitive, obsessive difficulty. And this one had to do with a broken lawnmower, and I was in some sort of repair barn trying to get this lawnmower fixed. There was a part that I kept trying to fit onto the mower, but it just wouldn't stay in place. I'd have to keep prying it up out of the dirt and trying to press it into place, only for it to fall off again. And this dream process seemed to drag on and on through a very long morning dream. Okay, now flash forward to this afternoon, you know, when I'm actually awake, and I'm in the kitchen and I notice a movement in the backyard through the patio door. I take a look out the door and I see that the neighbor boy who mows our lawn has shown up unannounced and rather unexpectedly. I'm glad to see him, though, because the lawn really needs mowing as a result of all the rain we've had recently. But usually, I have to call him on the phone a couple of times to get him to come over. Today, he's just come over on his own, so that's good. Then I hear him trying to start the mower. It runs for a moment and then dies, and I hear this process over and over again. Finally, he comes to the door to tell me that the mower is broken. I go outside and I fiddle with it and I try to get it started. No luck. Finally, I end up calling a mower repair place that I've used in the past. And in fact, this repair place is located in a barn out in the country. They come out and they haul the mower off to their barn for repair. Now, it could just be coincidence, my dream about the broken mower and then having it actually be broken the next day. Or it could be another one of those little reminders that during the altered state of sleep and dreaming, there's some other sort of seeing that wakes up. As I've mentioned before, we're a member of the Podshow Podcast Delivery Network, and we're participating in a promotion for GoDaddy.com, which is an international company supplying domain names, domain transfers, web hosting, and other services at rock-bottom prices. So if you go to our site at shrinkwrapradio.com and look in the left-hand margin, you'll find a link to three different promotional codes that will entitle you to some great discounts.
Hey, this is Matt Van Nuys, and you're on the couch with my dad, Dr. Dave.
Thank you, Matthew. It warms my heart to have the support of my kids in this project. And now a big shout out to Digger Story in Orlando, Florida, Frank in Australia, Tasha in Florence, Italy, Greg in St. Paul, Minnesota, Yuri in Israel, William in Paso Robles, California, Kim in Yuba City, California, Josh in San Jose, California, Patty in Santa Rosa, California, Mo in Baghdad, Iraq, Sharon in New Hampshire, Adam in Ann Arbor, Michigan, Ibarra in Lyon, France, Roger in Auckland, New Zealand, Ken in Buffalo, New York, Welmiad in Netherlands, Lynn in Portland, Ned in Australia, MT in Texas, Elsie in Louisville, Kentucky, Julianne in London, my sister Sherry in Ensenada, Rennie in Switzerland, Lausanne, Switzerland, Jerry in Denver. And who are these wonderful people, you ask, that they should get their names read on the air? Because they've been so generous as to put themselves on our Frapper map. If I didn't read off your name, you know what you've got to do. Please, please put yourself on our new Frapper map, which allows you to place a digital pin on the location where you live. You can get there from our site at shrinkwrapradio.com or by going directly to www.frapper.com/shrinkwrapradio. Frapper is spelled F-R-A-P-P-R, no E. So far, we've only got 30 pins on the map, actually not that many pins, one of which is mine. And the reason there aren't that many pins, get this, there are five names with no location. The whole point of the map is to see where you are. So please record not only your name, but where you're located. It gives me a thrill each time I discover a new pin on the map. Our weblogs show that we have over 1,000 of you listening to each podcast. So start planting those pins with pride so we can see where you are. Okay, let's take a look at some of the mail that we have received since our last show. We got a nice email from Andy who says, "Hiya there. Firstly, let me compliment you on your show. I stumbled across it this afternoon and have been listening nonstop. I'm a psychology student, and it's refreshing to hear a podcast that covers a good mix of psychology issues." And then Andy goes on to give me some technical advice about how I can get the show to show up better in Google and some other places. So, Andy, thank you both for your note and for your helpful technical tips, and I hope to hear back from you more about that. Speaking of hearing back, I got another email from listener Ken Valerio in Buffalo, New York, whose email I read last week, but I didn't give his last name. However, now I have permission to do so. And he writes, "Dear Dr. Dave, I wanted to send you an image of my latest painting entitled Paradigm Shift, as you spoke of these shifts in your last show. Thanks, by the way, for taking the time to read my email. It is always fascinating to hear oneself read by another and informative. You're a very generous host. Feel free to share my website if you feel so inclined. I've been getting a lot out of Joseph Campbell, as you suggested, and I thank you. Would love to hear more about your hero workshop. Keep on rocking the podcast world. All the best, Ken Valerio." And I really would like to recommend his website where you can see his wonderful artwork. And you'll find it at http://www.kenvalerio.com. That's kenvalerio.com. Really nice work there. I think you'll be glad that you took a look. I am really ever impressed by the intelligence and accomplishments of the listeners in this audience. I feel very privileged to have an audience like this. We received a nice note from Anthony in Melbourne, Australia, who writes, "Hello, Dr. Dave. I find your podcasts really interesting. Thank you for taking the time to create and share such thought-provoking stuff. It's much appreciated. I'm a psychology student and would be keen to listen to more podcasts in this area. I was wondering if you're aware of any other good podcasters out there doing psychology-related content. And if so, would you be kind enough to share them with me? Many thanks, Anthony." Well, Anthony, one show that I have recommended repeatedly is Insight Works. That's I-N-S-Y-T, Works. You'll find that at insightworks.com. You can find the link there, or you can find them on iTunes. And Robin and Suzanne, a husband and wife team, who are very steeped in Jungian psychology as well as other approaches, they do a really fine job of exploring psychological issues and looking at their own issues and looking at their relationship in a very wonderful and genuine way. In addition, I recently got turned on to a wonderful podcast that originates in your own country. It's ABC, the Australian Broadcasting Company. So it's a radio show and it's also a podcast. It's called All in the Mind. And they're doing something like I'm doing here, but at a very, very professional level. So I hope I don't lose any listeners as a result of the referral, but it is a very fine show that they produce there. Josh writes, First off, I would like to thank you for such great, insightful look at the multi-headed science that is human psychology. I've always been interested in this field, but have never gone any farther than reading a few good books and a little friendly analyzing of friends' problems. I've done the latter quite a bit due to the fact that for some reason, people with mental issues seem to be attracted to me. I know what you mean.
I have enjoyed their company, though, so I hope it has been a benefit to both. Anyway, keep up the great programming. I do have one issue. I'm an audio-video guy whose job it is to set up home theaters and the like, so I tend to be a little sensitive to sound-related issues. I have noticed this problem before with your show, but one particular show stood out to me. Show number 33 really had this issue. The main interviewee's voice came across quite nicely, but your voice and her brother's were very, very low. Thus, when she was speaking, the volume would be normal, but when one other person spoke, I found myself turning the volume up and down over and over. Perhaps you have some kind of mixer on your computer that would allow you to turn your mic input up without affecting the guest's voice. But anyway, I've gone on long enough. If you have any questions on this point, feel free to email me, and I'm local to you if you really need some physical help with that. By the way, I did hit your Frapper map. Have a great day, Josh. Hey, thanks a lot for the offer, Josh. Yes, I do have a mixer. I think I'm still learning how to use it, as you can tell. And I was aware of that problem on the last show. And part of what it had to do with was I was interviewing two guests at the same time, Dale and Gail Ironson, and they were on the same phone line, and they were on two extension phones, one of which was much louder than the other, and fooling with the mixer did me no good in trying to get it balanced. I was surprised, though, when I, you know, listened back to the show to hear that my own voice was also so low. So I'm hoping to get that piece of it smoothed out, at least. I was happy to hear from Kim, the teacher in Yuba City, whose email I read once before. And he writes, "Hi, Dave. Kim here of Yuba City. Just a quick note to tell you, I enjoyed hearing my email read on the last podcast. It was totally unexpected and was very gratifying. I've never been, quotes, published before. No, once before. I had this consuming crush on a girl in high school, and I wrote her a Shakespearean love sonnet and mailed it to her anonymously." Kim, I can so identify with that. "Somehow, I don't remember how, maybe a teacher sent it in. It was published in the Student Literary Journal. I don't know if she didn't notice the journal and thus never identified me, or saw it and didn't think I and my literary effort were worth her undying love. Thanks again, Dave, and I'll keep listening. Kim." Yeah, we never quite get over those high school crushes, do we? Finally, a note from William, who writes, "Hi, Dr. Dave. I just wanted to say thank you for the podcast. I've not walked down these paths in many in my years. It would seem you came along at just the right time, as I'm at a good point in my life to change direction and invent myself anew." Well, that's great, William. I hope that this series does serve some kind of inspirational purpose. And if it's doing that for you, I couldn't be more pleased. Listener email and feedback is the fuel that runs this show. You can send it to shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com. My username on Skype is ShrinkPod. I've even created a page on MySpace, though I'm not sure I understand what to do with it. And the name there on MySpace is also ShrinkPod. And we have a call-in number where you can leave voicemail. And we get hardly any voicemail, so I'd love to get some from you. That number is 206-888-2746. Please help spread the word about Shrink Wrap Radio to your friends and colleagues. If you have a podcast or a blog, we'd sure appreciate a plug there. I'm going to have yet another stellar guest for you next week. Dr. Gerald G. Jampolsky is a psychiatrist who founded the Center for Attitudinal Healing in Tiburon, California, and who's also the author of at least 9 books, including the popular Love is Letting Go of Fear. We close today's show now with a piece of PodSafe music. Lover of podcasting that I am, we'll close with Jeff Smith's anthem to podcasting, Not on the Radio. Jeff has become quite a star in the podcast music firmament, and you can find more by him and about him
by going to the link on our show notes at shrinkwrapradio.com. That's it for now. This is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind.
Somebody told me you're in San Francisco. They said you're working in a box,
yeah, a cubicle.
Somebody told me that you're not on top of the world. You're probably walking down the street with your earbuds jammed so deep in your ear,
yeah, you're going deaf.
You probably found this little MP3 for free. Does anyone around here still have a radio? Anyone here at all? Anyone here at all? You should go and see them out in Cupertino. It's way cooler out there.
Yeah, I think so.
But maybe you just like it in your cozy little world. Well, you can play this, but not on the radio. I made this just so I could let it go. Does anyone around here still have a radio? Out in Wheeling, West Virginia, we can make it on our own,
and we're doing just fine.
I can't afford your record, but it's out of sight. Well, you can play this, but not